And we're live on the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing very, very well. Spring is here. I'm pumped about it. How are you?
Good, man. I am in Tampa, hashtag long Tampa, and summer's here. I feel like to a certain extent, I live on the sun right now because the last week or so, it has been really, really hot. It's never gotten to 100 here in Tampa, but it's been like low 90s, 80% humidity. People are like, oh man, wait till you get to summer. Like, no, it doesn't really get hotter than this. It's just miserable kind of now. And it's going to be miserable in the summer. I say that I love Tampa, man, but it's hot.
Yeah. I was down there last week. I get it. But that's why you're going to Michigan in the summer. So kudos to you for escaping the heat.
There you go. Right. It's like, we had a short window, here where weather was awesome. Now in New York, where you are, it's, you know, I feel like that time of year, like spirits are up, like you get the sun out, walk outside with t-shirt and shorts. You're like, man, it's beautiful.
It's good. And I am thinking about hosting a small golf get together for commercial real estate Twitter folks in May. So more details to follow. It'll be tiny though. Not a big thing, but I do want to host an event. Anyway, what are we talking about today?
We don't have a guest today. We've been on an awesome guest train with these great guests, and we've got more great guests coming. We've got Moses Keg coming in a couple of weeks. We've got some great guests coming, but today we're just going to talk about our business, Greyline Investments.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to start at the beginning or talk about how things are going right now?
Let's, we've got a bunch of new listeners, I imagine. Anyone that has stuck with us since the beginning, like, man, you get a trophy. Reach out to us, we give you a trophy, right? So let's start with the genesis of, like, you know, give a little bit of like how we know each other and then how we got into real estate together.
Yeah. Okay. So John and I, we know each other from college. We both were class of 2009, West Pointers. We both played football, played the same position. Competed against each other to get a starting spot. And then eventually, luckily, we're both able to play. I moved positions. So both got on the field, a lot of reps. It was great. So our friendship started there. You stayed in the Army past the 5-year mark and was having a good Army career. I got out, worked in financial services. But as I've documented here before, I hated working as a consultant. I just didn't like working in big companies. I worked at Ernst & Young and then JP Morgan. In 2020, you reached out to me and you're like, hey, you own some rentals on the side. I own a couple of multifamily buildings in Oklahoma, amongst other things. You want to start doing real estate together? And I was like, okay, cool. Let's do it. And our goal when we first started was like, hey, let's just do like a house a month. Let's try to get a house a month. And we started looking for deals. You know, you start where everyone else starts. You go on Zillow, you try to talk to agents. You realize there's no cash flow on any of those deals. Pricing doesn't make sense. So about a month in, we started investing in direct-to-seller marketing, primarily text messaging. So we're like, hey, let's get a list of 10,000 property owners or landlords in Lawton, Oklahoma, Killeen, Texas, which is the home of Fort Hood. And let's just start texting these people and asking them if they want to sell their house. COVID, at this point in 2020, also becomes a thing, like right around the same time. And I think for like a 3-month period, there was distress in the market. Like people were scared, like, oh shit, what if the economy just collapses right now because of this pandemic? So we're sending these messages out and we lock up like 5 houses in, I don't know, 45 days, 60 days. We're like, okay, we can't afford to buy these. We're, you know, you're in the Army, like I'm growing my nest egg, but we're not rich by any stretch of the imagination. And we're like, oh crap, we got to flip these or wholesale these contracts. So we started wholesaling houses and it kind of steamrolled from there. Am I getting all this right? Like what am I leaving out?
Yeah, I think we knew enough about real estate to try to go after deals like wholesalers were, but we just didn't think it would work like it did. And it worked really good, right? We were fortunate that when we started, we were texting on our iPhones. And then quickly we found platforms where you could send mass text messages very fast, right? And we were some of the first people to start sending mass text messages and it worked really good.
Yeah, it was, looking back, it was too easy. You know, we would send out 10,000 text messages, get 2 houses, flip those contracts, make, you know, 10 to 20 grand a piece. Too easy, right? Buying things for about 70 cents on the dollar in some cases, sometimes less, right? Honestly.
And we could get a phone number and send it for like maybe 20 cents. Right. So, you know, you're talking 10,000. We could do that for, you know, we'd get a couple houses for $2,000 of kind of marketing spend, right? So let's say our average deal was 10 grand. We could do two houses for, you know, $2,000 of marketing spend. We were making 20 grand and we thought we were geniuses.
Yeah. Imagine how smart you think you are. You're like, wow, I could spend $2,000 in marketing and make 20 grand. Oh, everyone who doesn't do this is so stupid, right?
Like, for sure.
That's what you think.
Since we understood scale, quote, understood scale, what did we do? We said, well, if this works at this scale, let's double, triple, quadruple. And we did.
Yeah, we did, right? So we're starting out spending like $2,000 to $5,000 a month on marketing. Here, let's fast forward a year because there's a lot of story here, but let's just fast forward a year. We're spending $40,000 to $60,000 a month on marketing. And our costs just go up, right? At the beginning, you're getting something under contract for $2,000. By the end, it's costing $4,000 to $5,000, probably less than that, but I might be exaggerating, but it's getting expensive, right? And then sending out those messages, then you got to hire virtual assistants, right? You got to hire staffing to manage all those leads. Then you start adding cold calling and PPC. And at some point, text messaging got throttled or almost blocked for large scale wholesalers by Verizon and AT&T. If you're sending 10,000 messages or less, probably okay. If you're sending 100,000 like we were, those phone numbers are popping up as spam and that game is becoming over, right? So we start to realize that the problem with wholesaling is once you start to do a lot of volume, your marketing channels are just going to change forever because once something becomes too easy, everyone floods to it. Then that carrier, AT&T, Verizon, they get hip to it and they just block it and it gets throttled down. So it's like it's not a race to the bottom, but it's definitely a diminishing return business if you're trying to operate in multiple markets. So then we're like, hey, we got to find something else to do. So then what did we say?
Well, then we went to calling, right? We went from text messaging to calling. We grew a call center of over 20 people. I think 27 was the most we had. But right around that time, it was also the presidential campaign, right? So people were getting phone calls and text messages and iPhones started showing up as scam likely, right? And the scam likely, I was like, this is the end, right? So we looked at a lot of different things, but eventually we realized like, hey, we don't want to do this anymore. Like we were really good at virtual wholesaling and flipping. But being good at virtual wholesaling and flipping is a miserable life. Like you are, you know, one market adjustment from being completely ruined. You're surrounded by idiots and con artists. Like the single family game is idiots and con artists. There's some wonderful people out there, but in the virtual space where people can reach anywhere and in the like fake guru space, the training space, the mastermind space, on average, they're idiots and con artists. So like we hated that space and we could feel the fragility of that space.
Yeah, I would say that's accurate. Both in the people selling tech and courses, I think that's a serious, there's a lot of character flaws amongst the people in that community. But also like on the wholesaling side, you know, you try to sell a property you put under contract. Those buyers are like, those people are really, really sketchy too, right? There's lots, those guys, like if they don't get the best bid, they just try to steal the deal, right? So the whole process is super fragile. And then probably the number one reason you want to get off that hamster wheel is there's very little wealth building in flipping houses and wholesaling contracts. Yeah, you get some active income for sure, but that distracts you from holding almost anything. And once you have salaries, it's really hard to hold on to properties where you could extract 30 grand when you have employees that need to get fed, right? So like once you're operating at scale, that's a really tough nut to crack. So at some point we're like, hey, we need to be able to deploy money into something that we can hold on to that also pays our salaries and for our livelihood, for our families too. And I believe we immediately discarded multifamily for better or for worse. I think we assumed that the yields were too tight and the cap rates didn't make sense in most of the markets we were familiar with. And we were like, hey, what about mobile home parks and storage? And you take it from there. How do we get through that process?
Yeah, well, we were really good. We say the number's right around 200. We don't know exactly what the number was. We did something like 200 flips in wholesales, all direct to seller, or the majority direct to seller, right? So we felt really good with our marketing skills. In fact, that was, you know, we were good at many things in that business, but our only real competitive advantages was marketing, but then that advantage disappeared too, right? But we looked at mobile home parks and storage, like, hey, if we can keep going direct to seller and use some of these tactics, we're going to be really good at this. And then ultimately we had to pick one, and we liked storage because it wasn't a primary residence, because dealing with in the single family game, evicting tenants and, you know, some of that, like those are heavy emotional conversations that it can just be a pain in the ass to deal with that, right? To try to be a capitalist and have a heart in that business, it can be tough. We didn't want to explore that with mobile home parks. So we said, hey, let's go to storage. So we got into storage. We'll, you know, accelerate that conversation some, but the big thing with storage is we figured out a way to identify a storage facility for one point. We negotiated, got it, you know, it was on market, but we got it for $1.4 million. We got $1 million loan, and we raised $400,000 of equity, and we closed on our first storage deal, which was awesome. But the more awesome thing was, you know, within the first 60 days, we raised rents 20%, and we immediately created, you know, $500,000 of value or something like that. And it was like, holy shit, like it worked. Like it worked, and we've created more wealth in 60 days from this storage facility than we did in 2 years of slinging houses.
Yeah. Yeah. Having said that, do you regret doing houses first? Do you regret the first 18 months of our business?
No, not at all. Not at all. For two reasons. One is I'm a firm believer that wherever your comfort zone is, you want to push just outside that comfort zone, right? And I think we could flip and wholesale houses that was just outside our comfort zone. And then going from all the houses we did to a $1.4 million storage deal, like that was just outside our comfort zone. But if we would have went from nothing to $1.4 million storage facility, I don't think we could have done it, right? Like how we were raised, how big our bank account was, like, you know, our expectations, the ceiling we put on ourselves, whatever all that stuff is, I think we needed to go through that. The other thing is, I like to think we're decently smart guys, but we're decently smart guys that also just have like an unbelievable bias towards action, right? And if we would have went from zero to finding our first storage facility, it would have been hard to get some momentum. Where the great thing about single family is like, bro, you got action, you got seven intense conversation and seven intense decisions every single day, right? So like it is action, action, action. So we got to figure out how we operated. We, at one point we had more partners. We had to figure out that Frank and I came to blows, you know, you and I came to blows a couple times, but like we needed that to figure out like, hey, what's your role? What's my role? How do we do this together? What is our strategy? What are our, you know, core beliefs and how we're going to get there? I think we needed all that.
Yeah, I agree. I think single family and small multi too is a great sandbox to play in at the beginning, like you said, because flash to bang, it's quick, right? Hey, you send out direct seller marketing a month later. If you did a good job at that, probably going to get a few leads. You get to go through those negotiation processes, underwrite a house, which is pretty easy to do. Like, am I getting this for 70% of what the ARV is in most markets? And the other reason it's quick flash to bang is how the funding works in single family. It's most of it's hard money lending. For single family flippers. So if you find one lender that is willing to lend to your business multiple times a year, you're probably ready to go. Assuming you have at least some liquidity in your bank account to support the business, you can just start. That's it. So the starter costs are really low. Great, great place to get your teeth cut. Okay. So now we're in storage. We're doing our first deal. I remember you locked that up. I stood up the operations team. And then some point early, was it 22? We pivot our existing staff. And we did some layoffs after our single family business started to stall out, or we started to see the margins compress. We took our existing staff and started moving them over to our property management company. Then what starts to happen?
Well, this was end of 2021. We're like, hey, single family's dead. Okay. We had to lay a bunch of people off, a bunch of, virtual assistants in the Philippines. It was tough, right? Super tough. They did everything we asked of them, and our business couldn't support them anymore. We had to lean out. Difficult decision, but I think, you know, we did as right as we could by all those people by giving them severance and trying our best to hook them up with follow-on jobs. And then we said, okay, we're going to focus on storage. And we brought over Adam Parsons, who is our general manager, made him in charge of our ops team, and then brought over some of our Filipino virtual assistants to stand up call center. And we said, hey, we're not doing houses anymore. If we see an awesome opportunity on a house, we're going to say no, right? If we get leads on houses, we're going to give those leads to someone else. We're going to say no. And we're going to focus strictly on storage. And we bought an awesome facility in Lawton, Oklahoma. That was $3 or $4 million. Worked really well for us, right? Like got the wheels going. And then, you know, throughout 2022, well, you know, 8 to 10 storage facilities, purchase prices around 17 mil. You know, we just bottom line, we kicked ass all last year in storage and just rocked it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was good, right? Like, I think there's probably a lot of people that are thinking like, oh, you bought all that storage in 2022. Are you getting your ass kicked on your portfolio right now? Cause hey, pricing was high. And I'll just answer that question. We're doing well, right? Like I think next quarter we'll have distributions out on all of our syndicated deals. We've had a couple that are taking a little longer than we would like. Revenue is hard to drive in 2023, but generally feeling pretty badass about 22 as a year.
Yeah, some people might be like, you guys were late to the party, right? Like
we were though, storage. That, but we were late. Like if we were 2 years earlier, it would be nice.
I would say nice. We were late to the party, but we weren't too late to the party, right? Like we still got to party. And as I look at our portfolio today, I'm like, you know, if we could 10X our current portfolio, if we could just 10X that, I was like, I'd love to, you know?
Yeah. I agree. But, if we started in 19, I mean, storage was, it's just the way the storage went. It was trading at, you know, 8 caps, and now even tertiary stuff's trading at a 6. That's a pretty big increase in value. So,
I think to preface what we had to do all this just to set up the meat and potatoes of this episode. So if you're still here, awesome. Right. But we bought $17 million worth of storage, and all but one of those facilities were bought in the first half of 2022. Why? Because then we had interest rates go up, and we talk about the bid ask spread, meaning the bid is what a seller wants to pay, and the ask is what the bid is what the buyer wants to pay, and the ask is what the seller is asking. And that spread is like, hey, the seller is asking more than the buyer wants to pay, right? So between interest rates and the bid ask spread in the second half of 2022, we were only able to close one deal. Right. So we are rocking and rolling to start 2022, probably on pace to buy $30 million worth of storage, which is huge for us, right? Like 2021, we bought $1.4 million, and we're on track 2022 to do $30 million worth of storage. Second half, we couldn't get deals to work, right? Bought one deal. So far in 2023, we've bought one deal. We're really close on another deal. But the bottom line is this momentum that we had where we felt like we could get deals, we could underwrite conservatively, we could make things happen. That opportunity just hasn't been there. We've been working our asses off for 9 months and we've closed two deals.
I think it's interest rates are certainly part of it and the biggest thing driving this. But I think there's a couple of reasons why storage got really, really tough from, you know, August of 22 to now. And one, it's interest rates are up. So the cost of borrowing is up. So yields on existing prices are down, right? If you pay the same price that people paid 6 months ago, you have less cash flow. So that's certainly part of it. But what also has happened is interest rates have throttled single family home sales. I actually read yesterday that home sale transaction volume in the US is the lowest since 2010. Not dollar amount, just like strictly the number of transactions, right? So what does that mean? People are not moving. That's 30% of the customer base in storage. So what you end up seeing is you have high rates and then you have lower occupancies, and thus street rates then peaked somewhere around August as well for storage, right? So the price for a vacant 10 by 10 in a given city is likely slightly lower than it was in August of last year, right? So as an underwriter, you're like, okay, can't drive rents as hard, right? I can't expect rents to go up unless they're way below rent, mom and pop shop. Then I have higher interest rates. And investors are also trying to de-risk too, right? So they might be seeking less debt on a deal than in the past. So more capital is needed to close the deal. So you have so much downward pressure and sellers have no idea. Like sellers don't care, right? They're like, hey, my buddy down the street sold for $10 million. My stuff is worth $10 million. So like, we still have not seen bid-ask spreads come close enough together in storage to like put some gasoline on the fire. All this is so much inputs in a short period of time.
And we've gotten, or let me just quantify that, right? Like, what does that mean for us? When we first started evaluating a storage deal or underwriting a storage deal, we would say, we think once stabilized, we're going to be at 10% occupancy. And we think our expenses overall are going to be about 30%, right? So like broad brushstrokes, we've gone from stabilizing at 10% occupancy to stabilizing at 15% occupancy. And instead of 30% expense,
15% vacancy.
Oh, correction. Vacancy, yeah. Right? 15% vacancy. And instead of 30% expenses, 35% expenses, right? So those are just broad brushstrokes. But we've gone from, you know, a more aggressive underwriting model to a more conservative underwriting model, right? So now we're hoping to hit our numbers in a more conservative way. Why? Because we've seen behind the curtain some, and we have seen it can be tough, right? Like in a soft market, it can be difficult to drive rents. It can also be difficult to drive occupancy. So we have to have a larger margin of safety.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
So as we look to buy storage deals right now, what are we seeing? Okay, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing beautiful Class A multi-story facilities that I have no freaking idea how they can justify the prices. It's crazy, right? So we can't compete on those at all, right? Then we have what I would call more like Class B, right? Which is really nice facilities that are part non-climate, part climate in, you know, a primary market or secondary market, right? So think about, you know, like in Lakeland, Florida, a $7 million facility that was just built that is really nice, right? We can't get close on those either, right? Like you would have to underwrite really solid appreciation to make those numbers work at all, right? What we like is the tertiary market, the Hinesville, Georgia's, the Lawton, Oklahoma, the Columbia, Missouri, that are mom and pop owned, right? And as we look at those opportunities right now, basically every broker is marketing those based off the pro forma NOI, meaning that brokers aren't leaving any meat on the bone for us. They are valuing that property or marketing that property at a price that already captures all of the upside. So they're saying, here's what this facility could produce if you do all the work. But it's not giving us any of that money. So the only deals that we're seeing that work for us are in places that we don't want to buy. Middle of nowhere, Tennessee, we can get a property. Middle of nowhere, Arkansas, we can get a property. But guess what? We don't want to buy storage in the middle of nowhere, Tennessee or Arkansas, right? We want to buy in places where we think population is going to continue to grow and it doesn't have, you know, the town isn't, you know, dependent on one employer, right? So we don't want to explore those opportunities.
Well, what if someone asked you then, hey, if the unlevered yield on cost, meaning the take your total cost, purchase price plus all costs, and like what yield do you want off that, right? Unlevered, assume no debt. Let's say you want 8%. You can get that in middle of nowhere, Arkansas, for sure, right? If it hits your unlevered yield on cost, why not just buy it?
Because everyone likes to talk about cash flow now because it's easy to understand, right? And that's what you're saying. It's like, hey, we have an unlevered yield on cost that we can predict for years 1 through 3 pretty good, right? So let's say you can go middle of nowhere, Tennessee, and you're going to have a 10% yield, right? By year 3. You're like, boom, this is 10% yield, right? And then you look at a place, you know, let's call the Savannah, Georgia, right? And in Savannah, Georgia, you can only get a 5% yield by year 3. You're like, hey, let's go to middle of nowhere, Tennessee, all day, right? But the bottom line is there's more risk for that place in the middle of Georgia. So past year three, it gets much more difficult to predict whether it's going to go up, down, or stay the same. We're in Savannah, right? Or a stronger market, even though you're starting at a five and you can't predict past year three, I think the probability is it's going to go up in years four, five, six, seven, and eight, right? So that's why it's kind of apples and oranges. And some people are like, hey, I just want cash flow, right? I don't want to invest for appreciation. But the bottom line is it's really difficult to compare apples to apples, those two products. And ultimately, I think our comfort zone is we want to be in a place that we're like, we feel confident we're going to get appreciation, right? Like we don't know for sure. We can't quantify it for sure, but we feel confident that we're going to get solid appreciation there that is greater than the national average.
Yeah. I think it's also just, it's really hard to predict exit caps or what the value of something is in a city with like one storage facility, right? Like you're hoping the next buyer can value it at a same exit cap that you did a couple of years previous. And that's just really hard to predict. So I think you don't know if the difference between Savannah's exit capitalization rate and Jackson, Mississippi's is 300 bips. You don't know if it's 400 bips or in 5 years, if it'll be even bigger than that. You don't know the spread. And anyone who says they know the spread, I think is being a little foolish. And here's another reason why we can't just look at things as unlevered yield on cost. We're doing well, but we're still trying to get rich, right? Like we're not at the point where we're just clipping coupons over here. Like in order for us to hit our financial goals, we need refinances and we're going to probably sell some properties, right? Like in the next 5 to 10 years, like we're going to want to our promotes to kick in. So we're not just buying stuff to clip a coupon. So I think equity matters for us.
Well, I think to me, I just go back to like, I'm a simpleton, and the old, you know, Warren Buffett model was cigar butt investing, meaning he'd find an underpriced cigar butt, he'd get the last couple puffs of it, and then he'd sell it, right? And that's kind of what we've done in storage, is we've bought value add opportunities, stuff that like we'd have to be idiots not to squeeze out some value and be able to sell, right? Where you know, the Charlie Munger came in and said, hey, quit doing the cigar butt investing, buy great companies for a fair price, right? And so that is moving up the value chain. But the bottom line is that stuff works out in the long term, but in the short term, it's harder to make money, right? So we're at a place right now where we want the value add opportunities so we can make money in the short term, but we're evolving to that spot where we want to get awesome, you know, investments that just continue to grow over the long term. It's tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's easier. It's kind of like single family housing, like we talked about before. Flash to bang, it's faster to get money in the door trading cigar butts, right? It works.
Warren Buffett like got super, super rich. Some people in the Warren Buffett bio talk about it like it was a mistake. Like, no, he got really, really rich by doing it. Like it absolutely works.
Yeah, this is just the hill that we chose to climb. You know, like if we do this for 1,000 years, I hope we're not buying stuff in cities of 20,000 people, right? Like if you live forever, ultimately, you probably would end up, if you were good at your job, in like Los Angeles, New York City, and like big primary markets making those trades, because that's the best lifestyle and the best place to park money. But you can't start there, obviously. So,
right. So are we going to just continue sitting on our hands waiting for the storage market to change? Or are we using this podcast to talk about something new, Frank?
Oh, we are. It was your idea. So I want you to do most of the talking. But yes, we're not pivoting away from storage. Our property management company is doing really well. Love our team. We're hopefully locking up a storage property this week, actually. Contract is out. But we're going to add in multi-tenant industrial storage or industrial shallow bay. And your idea. So I want you to do the preface and the monologue.
Oh boy. Okay. So it started... there's a lot of thoughts that go into it. I think the first concept that went into it was this idea of compounding, right? And I felt like Frank and I, you and I always say we do best in person, right? Like we are relationship guys, where I think sometimes we can be intimidating from afar, but once we can be within arm's reach of somebody, we tend to really get along and develop relationships with people. And I felt like because our business was remote and we're buying storage facilities across the Southeast, we weren't able to compound those relationships, right? So that went into it. And then I felt like, you know, we were strictly doing the value add, but we weren't in locations that we were going to get tailwinds or appreciation. I was like, I really want to get to places where we can do value add investing and we can still have that margin of safety, but we can be in a location that gives us some tailwind. And I moved to Tampa in part so we could invest here. And we've realized like these storage opportunities in the Tampa Bay area, there's just not enough of them and they're not trading at a price that is interesting to us at all. Right. So and we're deal guys, right? Like we love I don't love operations. I can't say that. I hate operations, but our company is really good at operations. Between you and Adam, like we have a great operations function. But I'm a deal guy. Like I want to do deals, right? And there's just not enough storage in around Tampa, the I-4 corridor for us to execute around here. So, you know, the compounding, the being in a better market said, hey, let's start looking at another asset class. And we talked to a lot of people and I'm confident that the management of industrial properties is going to be less operationally intensive than our current storage business, right? And there's a ton of industrial properties in Tampa that we can buy today. And oh, by the way, some of the cap rates that they're trading at are much better than storage in the middle of nowhere, right? So what's all that to say? We are expanding our buy box. We're not pivoting, but we're evolving and expanding our buy box to include industrial properties. We're going to start in Tampa, Orlando, Jacksonville corridor within Florida. What are we looking for? We're looking for, probably under 25,000 square feet, maybe up to 50,000 square feet, but to start multi-tenant, properties that have a value add component. I think the perfect opportunity for us is somewhere between, four and 10 tenants that have below market rents, but at that price can cash flow on day one, right? So we can buy a facility, it cash flows or comes really close to cash flowing. And then over the course of 2 to 3 years, we get market rates in place and we take a purchasing at a 6.5 to 7 cap, and we can take it to a 9.5 cap over the course of 3 years by really managing that facility at a high level.
So being that you're that's a good explanation. Being that you're the acquisitions person, how does your job differ working, you've been doing this for a couple months now, prospecting this stuff, although we haven't really mentioned it until today. How does the experience differ from what you were doing in storage on the acquisition side?
The biggest thing is it's in person, right? Like it's in-person conversations, which I feel like it just one lunch in person is probably the rapport building of like 10 phone calls, right? So like, I feel like I can be better for our business development, for our acquisitions, for our sales, by being in person, right? So I think that's what it looks like. It also, you can ask a lot more questions, right? Like when I go to have these meetings with industrial brokers, I can ask lots of questions and I can push the uncomfortable questions that over the phone, you don't have body language and stuff to know how hard you can push, right? But I feel really good about my intel on Tampa Bay Industrial because I ask uncomfortable questions about the market and about brokers and about, who to trust, who not to trust, what's good, what's bad, how are things moving, how can I get an edge, where's the margin? I can ask all that stuff. So my learning curve has been able to be a lot steeper or a lot faster than it could over the phone talking to brokers.
Yeah, I think also being local from my vantage point, I think the value of those relationships goes up a lot, right? Like hey, let's say a broker out of Lakeland, Florida, you do a deal with them or we do a deal with them. Obviously, they're incentivized. If the property pops up 2 miles down the road, they're incentivized to bring you the deal, right? Brokers are always going to do that. And that's how a lot of the off-market deals trade in the industrial space. Whereas in storage, because everything was tertiary and brokers were just calling every seller all over the Southeast, the whole Sun Belt's been just pounded by brokers. That broker might sell a deal in Hinesville, Georgia, but because the buyer is in New York or Florida or whatever, they're not really incentivized to call them for every single deal and just close it off market because the buy boxes are more vague, right? They don't know what markets the buyer is interested in. So everything just goes out to the broad market. Everything gets an OM. Everything goes out to LoopNet and Crexie, and nothing's kind of like traded inside the community. So you end up always having a really, really big bid, or like five bidders in every single storage deal. And that trend has like really started to accelerate over the last 6 months. So there's very few true off-market deals in tertiary storage right now, at least from our vantage point. If someone else can find them, good for you. We'll buy them from you. But I have not seen it.
Yeah. And it's complicated, right? Like I get some pocket listings, but I don't get any pocket listings that the price is something we can action, yeah, you know? Right. So it's tough. And, you know, the brokers, like you say, the brokers are smart enough. The storage brokers are smart enough to know like, hey, you know, if I bring John this deal and he buys it, the chances that he buys the next deal is really, really low, right? Where, you know, in Tampa Industrial, these guys know like, hey, if I bring John a deal and they buy this one, there's a really good chance the next one that looks very similar, they'll buy that too, right? So it's a different game.
Yeah. If you can get to be, you know, the top 3 to 5 buyers in a given location, like that's the fight you're fighting essentially.
For sure. So let me put you on the spot, Frank. Like sure. what are a couple things that excite you about this opportunity? And then on the flip side, what are a couple things that like we are still wrestling with, or that we don't know, that we're trying to figure out?
That's a good question. I think what's exciting about it, right? We're investing in a place where we both believe the long-term population growth and the demographics are really, really strong, right? I think we're not having this conversation if we do not believe in the Tampa MSA, Orlando, and Jacksonville and that corridor, right? So we just believe that the demographics are good. Vacancy is super, super low. I think it's hovering between 2.5% and 3% on this asset type, which shows really, really good market demand. And there's less risk of oversupply, in my opinion, than there is in storage in the long term. So I think that's all really, really, really good. It's also trading, like we mentioned before, at higher yields, even when compared to cities with worse demographics, right? So I think that's really, really attractive. Lastly, a lot of these deals are triple net, meaning the tenant pays for taxes, insurance, and maintenance, except for like the roof, right? Like landlord's still responsible for large CapEx, but day-to-day stuff that falls on the tenant. So that reduces a lot of operational strain. And we're used to ops. Storage is a very ops-heavy business, and I love our ops team. But having a business that shoots off at the current time, probably higher yields in good locations with less operational strain, that's a good business, right? So those are probably the main reasons we're excited about it. What we don't know, right? Funding, I think, is somewhat of an open question. We've been having conversations with people that provide lines of credit, larger ones, right? We have banks that we've worked with that can provide debt. We have our storage investors that have given us $7 to $8 million in equity to this point. Are they going to follow us if we go down this path? Are we going to lose some of those investors? Is the funnel going to change? Those things we don't know. So that's a little scary. But I think, you know, on our first deal we do, there's probably some trust that we'll figure it out. Like, you know, figure it the fuck out, FITFO, right? Like we have a good high degree of that, I think, in our blood. So I think that's going to happen. But we don't know exactly how this is all going to shake out because we haven't done our first deal. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think as we talk about a Scarbot versus just buying awesome assets and awesome locations, like this is a step in that direction, right? Like we're not going to be able to find likely the deals that we could in storage where like, hey, by day 60, like it's an ACAP, right? Like we're not going to be able to do that. But I do think we can buy deals where by year 2, it's likely an 8 cap, right? Mm-hmm. And then with some appreciation and some good luck, by year 5, it can be a 10 cap plus, right? But that being said, like we can't model that out exactly, right? But I think we're going in that direction, which I'm excited about. But then, yeah, you know, we've syndicated every deal to this point. Every deal we've done has been a syndication for the one deal. So we're exploring funds. We're also exploring like, you know, we've been mostly individual investors with some, you know, family office / wealth management companies funding us. Like we're exploring that. Do we want to keep, you know, that looking the same, or are we looking for some, you know, larger sponsors to get this ball rolling, right? Those are things that part of it will be depending on what deals present themselves. But another part of it is like, you know, we're going to have to make a decision and go with it and, you know, be open to every option as it presents itself.
Yeah. It, And it's going to almost a guarantee that we get tested there or challenged, because our average check size right now is probably 75 grand. Actually, it's more than that because we've had some large placements, but it's not big, right? But if you start going down this path where you're buying industrial properties in a large MSA, at some point, the price points we buy at are going to go up. There's just going to be more expensive properties in those zip codes. So a $10 million deal, if you do this for long enough, it's going to pop up, right? So we're going to be stressed to get bigger check sizes and find larger partners over time. It's really hard to raise 10 million bucks, 50 grand to pop. Like, the legal costs of closing deals like that with that many investors are really, really high. It's a ton of work. The people who do that, like the Grant Cardones for those large, you know, all that type of stuff, that's not who we are right now. So I think we're going to be pressured to find the family offices, find, you know, people that have $2, $3 million of dry powder to deploy. And right now we only have one or two of those, I think, in our fund operation. So we'll be tested there for sure. That's going to be a challenge.
No, I agree. I'm excited though, right? I'm excited. We're in a position, like we thought about, like, hey, is this the pivot versus evolution, right? And the idea is, like, we're good at storage and we want to be good. And right now we own 200,000 square feet. And I hope over the next couple of years, we can get to 1 million square feet. I really do. But that deal flow is going to ebb and the deals there are going to ebb and flow, right? We're going to be ready to take advantage of them when they present themselves. But also being, you know, an aspiring real estate private equity company, I'm excited for this opportunity too. I think as we fast forward, we're a company that can take advantage of opportunities, that has some core competencies in storage and industrial, and we continue to grow, man.
I agree, man. It's we don't know everything that's going to happen, but that's also part of the fun of doing what we do. We get to pick what we focus on, and we solve problems. And I'm fully confident in our storage team to manage the properties while we tackle this new endeavor. And I'm pumped, man. I'm really excited.
Awesome. Appreciate you listening. Okay. Thanks for coming along on the journey. We got some good guests coming up. Do us a favor, tell a friend about this podcast as we continue to grow it. Leave us a review if you're really feeling motivated. Join our email list, right? Email list is growing. We got some exciting stuff coming out there. Forward those emails to a couple friends that you think might be interested. But thanks for listening. Appreciate you. Frank, take us out.
Hey, we'll see everybody next week. Peace.